You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Ben Langlands, and he's going to be talking about his collaborative, which is Ben Langlands and Nikki Bell, and we're going to explore some of their work. Ben, I want to thank you for being with me today.
Hi, Brainerd. It's very nice to be talking.
And before we begin, I wanted to ask about your practice, but where are you exactly? I know you said before the interview you're just outside of London.
We're based in Whitechapel in East London, just east of the City of London. But at the moment, we're in a studio just outside London in Kent, so it's about an hour's drive from our studio in Whitechapel. We've been in Whitechapel since about 1980.
So let's talk about what you're working on now. I know you've been very busy these past few weeks and months and probably decades, but what are you currently involved in working on?
Well, the thing that we're working on right at this moment that's taking most of our time is an installation we're making for Piccadilly Circus Underground Station in the centre of London, which is actually a memorial to a man called Frank Pick. Frank Pick was the first CEO and first sort of managing director of London Transport. He kind of invented it in the form that we understand it today. When he started at the beginning of the 20th century, sort of by accident, he had no experience in this kind of thing, but he found himself in this position. And he basically, it was his kind of vision that amalgamated all these different dysfunctional transport companies, and he created the integrated network. And one of the interesting things, there are several interesting things about him, but he had a kind of utopian vision for when he was kind of looking at cities, thinking about cities. And he really believed in art and design, although he was not trained in art and design or architecture at all. But intuitively, he understood their value. And so he commissioned really great artists like Man Ray, Moholy Nagy, and Paul Nash, and architects like Charles Holden, the kind of leading English modernist architect. He commissioned them to design the infrastructure for the transport network. So the very kind of powerful public image that London Transport has was actually devised by him. You know, the iconic map, the typeface, which is still in use today, he commissioned in 1915. It's considered by many people to be the first modern typeface. Yeah. And he, the great station architecture and amazing poster art designed by these artists. So he really put art and design at the center of everything as a way of kind of making the whole kind of transport network visible and understandable to people.
Hmm. That's fascinating. And so in making this kind of homage to him, what are you actually building inside there? Is it a construction or a mural? What are you actually creating in the system?
Well, when we were asked if we would do this, we were invited to go to the archives of the London Transport Museum to do some research. And we were going through his personal papers, and we stumbled across, we discovered in the margin of his lecture notes, a kind of little period table or equation that he'd written, he'd kind of scrawled in the margin. And it was just eight words, and the eight words were beauty, immortality, utility, perfection, righteousness, goodness, wisdom, and truth. And these were separated by with a little graphic sign that is used to signify that one thing leads to another, or one thing is greater than another. And we saw that, you know, while he was writing out his lecture notes, he was also kind of almost doodling and daydreaming in the margin, but in a very profound way. He was trying to kind of grapple with the significance of art and design, and in a way how with art and design you can transform everyday qualities into eternal values. So we have taken this fragment of text of his and we're making it in monumental bronze letters using the typeface that he commissioned in 1915 from Edward Johnston. And we're installing that at Piccadilly Circus on the travertine marble wall. And we're also installing a vitreous enamel roundel, the logo of London Transport, which will be backlit with LEDs. I don't know if you're familiar with the Piccadilly Circus station, but it's a beautiful 1920s environment. It's a circular station, very beautiful plan, and it's lined with travertine marble and it's trimmed out in bronze finishes. So we're kind of working with the materials that are there, but we're working in a conceptual way with his own words. We're giving him back his voice in the station that he commissioned.
That's very beautiful. It sounds like an enormously exciting project, not only because of the location and the scale of it, but the idea of paying homage to that kind of what I see as sophistication in design is wonderful, because perhaps there's more of that in London, but in the United States, and this may just be my perspective, but that kind of level of urban planning and design is not something we see today. And I'm talking specifically about what you're saying that Pick was involved in. It seems like we wish.
Yeah,
that
no, I mean, I really think you're right, and we don't normally see it in Britain either. It was highly unusual, and in a way, in the kind of odd British way, it sort of happened by accident. And in a way, he was working in a space where nobody else was working, so he was able to develop this whole thing kind of intuitively, just based on his own kind of faith. And he was actually a lay preacher, so he's a very spiritual man in a very kind of understated way. And apparently, he was very shy. But he had this incredible tenacity, and he used to work a 20-hour day. And he actually worked himself to death. He started in something like 1908 as a very, very young man, and he died in 1941 when he was 63. But anyway, he was really driven by this incredible vision, and he really believed in the city, and he really believed in making the city a bigger place. I mean, it sounds a better place, and it sounds slightly naive and utopian these days, but at the same time he had a huge impact, and the kind of design image of London Transport is, has been a very successful image. It is a very it basically, despite its problems, it does function very well. It's a very well integrated system, and it was an incredible achievement. In fact, Nicholas Pevsner, the architectural historian, said of Frank Pick that he was the greatest patron of the age, or of any age. And he also said that no single person had had such an impact on the appearance of London since Sir Christopher Wren, who was the architect of St. Paul's Cathedral and numerous churches after the Great Fire of London. So that's quite, that's quite an accolade. That's quite a thing to say about somebody. At the same time, he's not known in London at all, which is the reason why we're making the memorial. That's why we've been commissioned to make it. It will be unveiled on a week on Monday, on the 7th of November, and that will be the 75th anniversary of his death.
That's very interesting, and it makes me wonder why more people like Pick don't emerge today. Do you think it was his educational background? I mean, obviously there's a number of things that come to bear on how he came to be the person, or as you're saying, get the incredible accolades that he's gotten in terms of his impact on London.
Mm.
But why don't we see something like that today, you think? Obviously, artists like yourselves are also working in the public realm and having a large impact as well on our visual and conceptual experience as we move through cities. But what is it that you think gave Pick such sensitivity and sophistication? Was it an education of a certain kind, or were we just lucky that someone like him happened to kind of fall out of the sky?
Well, I think it's a very good question. I mean, the answer is we don't really know, and I suspect it was some kind of innate talent that he had, and that was coincidentally aligned with kind of the right situation. He was the right person at the right time. I mean, kind of analogy one could perhaps say is, firstly, you could kind of comment that at that time, mass urban transport was really a very new thing. And there were very few cities in the world that had it. You know, London and Paris, Chicago and New York. Even in Tokyo, it hadn't been developed. So generally, you know, the London transport system is the oldest in the world, and the underground railways in London were actually started running in 1852, so they were very, very early. It was already an old system when he came to it, but it was different railway companies. They were all losing money, and they were all fighting like cats in a sack, and he was the one who rationalized it. But the thing is, I suppose the other thing that also didn't really exist in the way that we understand it today is corporate identity, for want of a better word, or, you know, brand management, public image. These kind of things were not really understood in a very kind of coherent and managed way that we understand them today. And I think one of the reasons why we don't have a person like this emerge in this kind of context today is because everything is so managed, there's so many committees, people are so cautious, they don't want to get things wrong, they fear the consequences of if they try to innovate and it doesn't work out, that there'll be, you know, terrible negative results. But in those days, this was a new area, and so in some ways, maybe we could draw a comparison maybe with the world of the internet, where the comparison is not exact, but in some ways, you have this situation where the internet, of course, has only existed for, you know, we could say, in the form that we understand it now, for barely 20 years. And suddenly, all of these talented people emerge, and these huge ventures have established themselves, you know, whether it's Microsoft or Apple or Facebook or eBay or Amazon, and almost out of nowhere, from being completely invisible 10 or 20 years ago, they've now come almost to dominate our lives, and they've got huge profiles in our culture and our daily lives. And that's because it was an open zone. It was a free area. These people made the rules. They created the infrastructure. It was all a kind of new territory. It was like discovering a new solar system almost. And I think in his own way, Pick, you know, integrated transport system didn't exist until he came along. And so I think, you know, he was an innovator and, an early adopter is what the terms we'd use now, I suppose.
Absolutely. And so to talk about the work that you and Nikki have done since your meeting in 77, maybe just to go back to that time a little bit, because there's so many projects you've done in so many mediums. How is it that you began to work together as a collaborative, you know, because you were neither an architectural firm, in the proper sense of the word, or artists,
Yeah, we met at art school in 1977. And, you know, we met and got to know each other and just we got on. And then one day we thought, why don't we make an artwork together? We made an installation called The Kitchen, where we installed two kitchens side by side. And the idea was that Nikki would make an old kitchen. And in those days, London was in the 70s, and it was it was a kind of financial recession, and there was whole streets of abandoned buildings, and we loved exploring these old places, and we used to collect abandoned artifacts from them and make tableaux out of them, combine them in different ways. And so we decided, well, what we'll do is we'll build two rooms, two kitchens side by side, and one will be an old kitchen made with all these objects that we salvaged from collapsing abandoned houses, and then we'll make a brand new kitchen next to it where everything is shop bought and shiny and new. And we interconnected them with a window so you could walk into the old kitchen and look into the new kitchen. You couldn't actually enter the new kitchen. But everything in the new kitchen was, we constructed tables and shelves out of glass and mirror and chrome. So, and in the old kitchen, it was like smelly, rotting, rusty old artifacts that we'd rescued from abandoned houses. And you could walk in and stand in this old environment and look through the window into a sparkling new kind of mirror image of the environment you were standing in. And we lit the new kitchen with light projected through prisms. So there was kind of spectrum of colors, you know, rainbow spectrum of colors rushing through the glass shelves and bouncing off the mirrored table and all that kind of thing. Anyway, we started making this installation. Nikki was, we thought, would make the old half, and I would make the new half, and then we just realized it was easier to help each other make the whole thing together. So we made the whole thing together, and then we just carried on working together. We never thought of doing anything else. It was always more interesting and exciting to work together, and so we just carried on. It wasn't a kind of, it was just an intuitive, you know, development.
But it's, you've, that's very exciting. So you've done those kind of artworks, but how does that move into doing full-scale architecture? You know, you've also worked in architectural scale.
Yeah, we don't have any architectural training, formally speaking. We just love architecture and we love buildings. And when we first left art school, we used to restore buildings for people as a way of earning money because, you know, we didn't have any... at that time, you know, we didn't have any shows. We couldn't sell our work very easily. We'd only sell one piece, you know, every few months or something. So we had to earn a living somehow. So we started restoring houses for people and building furniture and things like that. And we loved buildings anyway. We loved exploring environments. So it just developed out of that, really. And, you know, then we began to make architectural models, and we realized we could use architectural models as an expressive medium and a conceptual medium. And the first model we made in that way was the basement of the National Gallery in the Trafalgar Square in London. And we incorporated that in the seat of a chair. And then we realized that there was potential to talk about, you know, relationships between people and both at the individual level and at the social level and aesthetically and, you know, technically and economically, by using architecture, you know, architecture being a kind of public language that we're all familiar with. And so we just kind of explored from there, really. So we work with it at all different kind of scales and sizes and different sort of levels, really. We're just fascinated by it and we love it.
And that sounds like such a, you know, I mean, in a way, a too intuitive and natural way of approaching everything. Yet there's also an amount of you're obviously intellectual compatibles, and you're and have a level of sophistication that I would imagine comes from your art school background. But art school, I would think, even at that time, was not encouraging this kind of multi-interdisciplinary approach.
No.
So how is it that both of you felt comfortable in creating what's now considered, you know, a little more normal, that architects and artists can move between the fields? But then I would think there would be some resistance. So I guess what I'm asking is how you
how we negotiate
each other. Yeah, how you negotiate.
Yeah,
that, exactly.
Well, you know, it was, as I said, you know, it's just an intuitive decision to start working together, and we decided we just carried on doing it because it seemed so exciting and interesting. Anybody who knows us will tell you that, you know, we're very different people. Our personalities are very, very different, but somehow, you know, it works together. And we seem to care about the same things to the same degree, even though we come at them in very different ways, as individuals perhaps. And when we started working together at college, the tutors actually, with one exception, the tutors spent their time trying to separate us or distinguish, work out who was doing what, which was completely impossible, and they failed utterly. But there was one tutor who totally supported us all the way through. Anyway, we just kind of carried on. I mean, when we started working together, we were only very vaguely aware of Gilbert and George, but we quickly became aware of them. And then, bizarrely enough, we met them quite soon afterwards and got to know them a bit. And our studio is quite close to them, to theirs, well, very close to theirs in East London, coincidentally. Yeah, it was quite unusual in those days. I mean, now it's much more normal. But even then, we knew that lots of other people collaborated. I mean, we knew, you know, architects collaborate, engineers collaborate, you know, even playwrights and collaborate. The film and television worlds are full of people collaborating. So we knew it was perfectly, you know, appropriate and normal and made sense. And it made sense to us, so we just carried on.
Well, I imagine I was going to mention Gilbert and George, and I imagine that they were very supportive. I mean, as well as the teacher that you mentioned, I would think that just the way Gilbert and George were working at that time and together must have been tremendously supportive of the direction that you were moving in.
Yeah. I mean, we're very different because Gilbert and George's work is very kind of, I mean, it reaches out everywhere, but it's very kind of autobiographical, you know, as figures, they're right at the center of their work. And we're not like that at all. You know, our work is not autobiographical in that sense. We don't feature ourselves in our work in the same way. So we're very, very different. But yes, of course, they were important figures to us because, you know, we were aware of them and we immediately could identify with the what they were doing and, you know, the huge commitment that they had made. We still do.
Because I think it's also about authorship, isn't it? I mean, you know, we talk of Gilbert and George or Langlands and Bell, and these are two authors working together, whereas, you know, in the art world, and playwrights, as you say, also collaborated. But often, just as in filmmakers collaborating, the director seems to get, you know, most of the attention, even though it's a huge collaborative process, but you were also entering into a world, I would imagine, where it's difficult for institutions, galleries, and others to understand how they, and of course now that's normal, but then it's how do we deal with two architects, two authors, two artists at once, and authoring the same with equal, you know, intensity.
Yeah, no, it's definitely, I think it's, you know, it's something that's been shifting, you know. I mean, I think, you know, the kind of 19th century notion of the artist as a kind of heroic individual, you know, struggling away in a garret or, you know, working in the studio on their own, you know, attacking canvases or whatever. I think, you know, that has, you know, progressively been, you know, modified in the last sort of 40 or 50 years, and I think it's interesting when you look at people like Christo and Jean-Claude Ed Keenholz and Nancy Redding Keenholz. I mean, you know, when those kind of artists first became known and their careers kind of first became established, it was just Christo and it was just Ed Keenholz. But as they carried on working, it became clear that the work was actually collaborative, and then they wanted to acknowledge it publicly. So as the careers developed, then Jean-Claude, you know, was recognized as author alongside Christo. Sadly, she's no longer alive, but, you know, she's still recognized as the author. And the same with Ed Keenholz, although he's no longer alive, and Nancy is alive. So, you know, I think that's quite interesting to observe that was obviously a point of change, a transition, you know, that initially they couldn't acknowledge that they were working together, and then in time, over time, they did.
Well, that's exactly that's exactly it. That they couldn't acknowledge. I mean, I interviewed Christo and Jean-Claude, late Jean-Claude, and I remember especially Jean-Claude saying, "Oh yes, you know, we wished we could have said we were a collaborative at the beginning, but we were afraid to say that. We didn't know how that would be taken, and we didn't do it until much later on. But it was always collaborative. We were just afraid to say so." And that strikes me as so interesting, and so it takes a certain amount of, if the word is appropriate, a kind of a bravery on your part or early collaboratives at that time, because of however it was being perceived as perhaps the world
wouldn't
accept
it. Well, I think it would have been harder for them to establish themselves, you know, as artists at that level in the sort of late 50s and through the 60s as working collaboratively. I think that the kind of conventions were different in those days. You know, they have changed, and I think Gilbert and George have obviously been key in you know, pushing that change and facilitating that change, because, you know, they've been very innovative in that respect. But there are others like, you know, Bernd and Hiller-Becker and you know, various others, and now, of course, there are lots. But
absolutely. Well, it's wonderful to talk about this. Before we go, there's so many projects I'd like to talk about of yours. But is there a project in particular that you felt was, if it's not too grand a word, seminal to your working together? Something in the past that was so successful, just aesthetically or intellectually, that it something really gelled? Is there a project that would come to mind? It could even be like the chair you mentioned or something else, but I'm just wondering, was there something early in your career or mid-career that really seems to stand out to you as what projected the strength of both of you?
I suppose, you know, looking back, there are quite a lot of these occasions, and they all have meanings in, you know, they all mean something slightly different, or they have significance because they were a different kind of event. But I think, you know, as young artists, our first solo exhibition in London with Bookworks, or the second solo exhibition we did with Maureen Paley at her house in Beck Road in London's East End, or our solo show at the Serpentine Gallery in 1996, or the first show with Charles Saatchi and his gallery in 1992, the first Young British Artist Show. These exhibitions were all huge. You know, they all had a big kind of, in a way, they were massive opportunities, and they were very rewarding to do. And the, you know, the commission that we accepted to go to Afghanistan and research there, and the work we made, the House of Osama bin Laden, that was a huge challenge. That was very significant for us. It changes all the time. The bridge that we designed in Paddington in London was, you know, a wonderful thing to do. And in its own way, this memorial that we're making now, Beauty Immortality, at Piccadilly Circus, is very exciting for us. Yeah. A couple of years ago, we made new entrances for the Paris Metro at Porte de Vincennes, and they're two interactive entrances that they're glass, and the color of they're lit internally, and the color changes as the trams arrive and depart. They go from white to pink to blue. So all of these things that have different meaning and significance to us, but they're all very exciting, really. We work in so many different ways, you know, in the realm of architecture, but also with digital media and, you know, with architectural models and film and video, reliefs, you know. We find them all very interesting.
It's a wonderful sense of freedom that you've really given yourselves, which to me seems what's remarkable, and I'm sure has helped many other artists along the way. The ability to move between all of those fields that you've mentioned, and all of the incredible variety of projects that you've done, which is, perhaps typical of visual artists more than architects, to truly be moving between all of these things, to allow yourself the freedom for that seems also unusual.
Yeah, no, it is quite unusual. But I think it's, we've been very fortunate in that respect. And I think it's, we come from a kind of, the underlying it all is our interest in kind of relationships between people and the way they're expressed in different ways, and our interest in architecture and exploring that in a kind of way that is both aesthetic and conceptual combined. And I think that's the basis that allows us to move between different contexts and to work with different mediums. But we do notice that architects and designers these days are also less constrained by the traditional boundaries of their disciplines than they were in the past. And I think, there are various reasons for that, but I think that the internet and digital media, electronic information systems, these have all helped break down these barriers and created new opportunities. And I think the world has become a much more visual place in the last sort of 20 or 30 or 40 years, increasingly so. And so visual languages have become much more prominent. And I think people are responding to that professionally and in terms of how they how they participate. Participation has become a huge thing in art and architecture and design, whereas before I think people's consumption, if we can use that term, of these mediums and these disciplines was much more, in a sense, passive, I think there's been a sea change. And I think that those are very positive developments.
I think so, too. It's been wonderful talking with you, Ben. But before we go, I wanted to ask if there's any a question I've been asking lately, because it always seems to be so curious how people answer it. Is there a book or books you're reading now that you want to share with us?
I'm sort of between books. And if I'm honest, I don't get nearly as much time to read as I would like to get, because we're so busy with work that a lot of our reading is kind of research or of necessity. But I'll just mention very quickly a book that we read fairly recently, which we thought was amazing, and which was a book by an American chap called Joe Day, called Corrections and Collections. I don't know if you've come across this book. So he's from the West Coast, and the book is about the parallels and connections and overlaps between prison architecture and the architecture of the modern and contemporary art museum since the 1960s. Mm. And it's a really extraordinary book. And very, very interesting. And I've just picked up a new book. We've just been given a book called This Brutal World, which is a book about brutalist architecture. And so I'm just starting to look at that now. It looks really interesting.
Ben, I want to thank you for this interview, and also, of course, the wonderful work that you and Nikki have done together. Thank you so much.
Well, it's a pleasure. It's been very nice to talk to you, Brainerd.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.